Hello and welcome to another episode of your weekly podcast where we look at current topics and upcoming events from the crazy world of user experience, design thinking, information architecture, services. And what about usability? Today on the show we have upcoming UX related events, we have an interview, and we have several music specials. All this and nothing more, now on the show. From Berlin, this is ITV Radio. You're listening to show number 10. We're going binary. Yee-haw! Thank you. Recorded on March 18th. I'm your host, Jan Jurza. You find me on Twitter at IATV. Welcome, my friend. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really, really appreciate it. Continental and Se acaban los héroes, or something like that. I know my Spanish leaves some room for improvement. Today on the show, I talk to Dana Chisnell. Dana is, of course, one of the big names in usability consulting. She has done lots of work. She has always done super interesting projects. She has co-authored the book Handbook of Usability Testing, which is a must read, actually. And we'll be talking about the upcoming IS Summit, about designing democracy, and about ballot design. But before we play the interview, let's play another song. This is from Tel Aviv, Rutzi Buba. Take it away, guys. Let's play some IETV Radio sound bites. Every week I listen to lots of podcasts and other recordings. I collect some of them for you, my friends out there. I collect 1 minute segments, stream them out. Please follow the links in the show notes to listen to the entire original recordings. They are really worth it. And my 1 minute segments are just little suggestions. So first we have in the IETV Radio sound bites, Anthony Dunny talks about what if crafting design speculations. Interesting presentation. Then we have from the 5x5 TV network, John Gruber and Dan Benjamin discuss the new iPad. And then as a third soundbite, we have a very real special for you, my friends. I received an email and listen to this. It's the Doors LA Woman 40th anniversary radio special. The Doors are one of the greatest rock bands and LA Woman is one of the greatest rock albums ever, says Michael Hornet, president of Airplay Direct. It's a thrill to work with Rhino Records again while making available this terrific slice of rock history to all of our Airplay Direct radio stations. And of course, ITV Radio is an official Airplay Direct radio station. Otherwise, why would we call ourselves radio? Like an ITV radio, right? The email continues. The program is hosted by esteemed journalist Ben Fong Torres. Torres joined Rolling Stone a while ago. LA Woman would become the final album with Jim Morrison in the lineup, released just a few months before he died in Paris in, I think it was July 1971. So this is the third soundbite. And you know what? Let's play it now.
And although our work and the work we're interested in doing plays with possibility, we are always trying to establish some thread from the world that we're in now to the worlds that we're exploring. So, but the real point of all of this is to try and understand what are preferable futures. And of course, preferable means different things to different peoples, whether it's a company, the public, or a government. But we want to populate this space to try and generate, I guess, many, many different perspectives on different kinds of, not futures, not trying to predict the future, but to think of different possibilities, to have a discussion about what kind of future do we want and what kind of futures don't we want. And we think design is particularly good at doing this because we make stuff tangible, tactile, and we make invisible stuff visible. But of course, we can't do it alone, and it requires working with other political scientists, economists, ethicists, anthropologists, trying to capture this sort of knowledge and use design to bring it into a public realm where people can debate different kinds of futures.
What's better than the iPad right now? Right now, there's nothing else. There, people don't even care about the other things, it seems. Am I wrong in that? Because whenever I talk to somebody about this, a regular person, it's always the iPad. I'm always shocked and amazed at how many people who I know they're not geeks, they don't listen to these shows, they don't even care about podcasts in general. Regular people all know about the iPad. They know I talk about this stuff, and they ask me. And I used to get, when the iPad first came out, I used to get this question of, well, what should I get? Should I get an iPad or should I get this other Android thing? And I would talk to them about the pros and cons of each. Now, they don't even talk about that. It's the iPad seems to be the only thing. Isn't that, hasn't Apple succeeded in that way?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think, you know, that just, you hearkened back to it, but I think it goes back to the Steve Jobs analogy of trucks and cars, and that the PC, as we know it, all PCs, everything from, you know, the ones you think of like a big honking desktop with a big fan that you connect to a standalone monitor on your desk, to even things like the 11-inch MacBook Air, which is a lot different than what a PC, what we thought of as a PC, say 15 years ago. All of them are the trucks. And, you know, these post-PC devices are the cars.
After the success of Love Her Madly, Riders on the Storm was picked as the second single, and it charted in July 1971. But the song starts with the classic rain, storm, and thunder sounds we now associate with the beginning of Riders on the Storm. But just how did they come up with this idea? Well, take a listen to the studio outtake as Jim Morrison brainstorms during the recording session.
All right, this is called Riders on the Storm. Take 9.
Hey, that's a good idea. Thunder. That'd be good at the beginning. You could do it with cymbals. We'll send out to Arizona for some good thunder.
Ray Manzarek.
He said, we got to put in some rain and thunder. So sure enough, I mean, the whole thing starts with... And then that bass line... Another one. Ender Morrison.
Riders on the Storm. Riders on the Storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. Storm. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday. Let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die.
Thank you.
life will never end. Gotta love your man. Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm.
And somebody who knows who said, let's put on a whisper voice. If you listen very closely, Jim singing, Riders on the Storm. I thought it was absolutely brilliant, and I know people have loved it. It's like, it's the spirit of Jim Morrison leaving his body. Leaving his body in the bathtub in Paris. Just going off into infinity. And the last thing you hear at the end of The Doors' seventh album, at the end of The Doors' contract with Elektra Records, the last song Jim Morrison sang on planet Earth is that storm fading away. The storm and the rain. Riders on the Storm.
Riders on the Storm.
So today on the show, I'm talking to Dana Chisnell. Dana is from the Boston area, which is Massachusetts, the East Coast. She's an independent user researcher and usability consultant. Actually, super well known because she's been in the business for many years and she's the co-author of the Handbook of Usability Testing. Dana, welcome to the show. Welcome to ITV Radio.
Thank you. That was a very nice introduction.
I'm practicing in front of a mirror since 2 weeks. Dana, after being a usability professional for something between 20 and 30 years, you suddenly became an expert in butterflies, at least in butterfly ballads.
Yes,
could you tell
exactly.
us the story behind it, please?
Well, it's not so sudden, really, although it might appear to be. It's sort of like stars who are overnight successes. There's actually a lot of hard work that goes into that before someone actually discovers you. So the genesis of my butterfly story is not about a beautiful flying insect, but a form that is an election ballot. In the United States, election ballots are pretty complicated compared to ballots that are used in other places for a variety of reasons. And I won't go into those unless you ask me them. But what happened in 2000 in this very special place called Palm Beach County, Florida, was that a very well-intentioned public administrator, a local elections official, who was responsible for laying out and designing the ballot for the 2000 presidential election, she realized that she had lots and lots and lots of older people in her county. And one of the things we do as designers is sort of standard practice, and she knew this, is that you make the type bigger for older people so it's easier to read. And so she took a standard ballot layout that was used in lots and lots of places and just made the type bigger for the presidential races. And what happened then caused a kind of interlaced effect on this ballot layout. So how this normally worked is all the candidates were listed on the left side of a double page spread in kind of a booklet looking format. And when she increased the type size on the names of the candidates, they spread out onto the right hand page. And it was hard to tell then, it was hard to line up which candidates went to which place on the ballot to mark for that candidate. And so thousands of people actually voted for someone they hadn't intended to vote for. And this had a ripple effect of causing ballots to be recounted in Palm Beach County and throughout Florida, a number of lawsuits, and eventually the United States Supreme Court appointed George W. Bush as president, stopping the recounts and basically ending the election. So there were lots of investigations about what happened there. One theory was that there were actually security issues with the voting systems, with the tabulators. Another theory was that the system had been hacked somehow, or that there were problems with the counting software. But it really comes down to exactly how the ballot was designed. And that's not the first or the last time this had happened. What was important about that particular event was that the margin of victory was incredibly close. If you watched the television coverage that night as the election returns came in, the different stations kept going back and forth, calling the election for Gore or for Bush. And eventually it was settled by the Supreme Court. So by hundreds, possibly thousands of votes on the popular vote for that election. Now, this is something that really got me inspired to go work on design and elections. And I started by working locally in San Francisco, where I was living at the time, and then got invited to work on a project with Ginny Reddish for the National Institute of Standards and Technology to do research about plain language in instructions on ballots to determine whether using plain language made a difference in whether people made mistakes on their ballots. And in the meantime, I did a lot of volunteer work with the Usability Professionals Association Usability in Civic Life project. And that was a rich experience on a lot of different levels, including with Whitney Quisenberry and a bunch of other wonderful people creating something we call the LEO Usability Testing Kit, the Local Election Official. That's what LEO stands for, Usability Testing Kit, where we pared down usability testing to its essence and created a little toolkit for people to test ballots themselves.
So right now you are raising funds to do a very special ballot design research. Is this correct?
Yeah. So the federal government has commissioned design research about ballot design over the years, including a big project by AIGA in their Design for Democracy project in 2006 that was published in 2007 that generated a beautiful report of design specifications based on user research and usability testing, months and months of it. But this is sort of the Cadillac version of what a ballot should look like. And
is it publicly available?
It is publicly available. You can download it from either eac.gov or from AIGA's website. It's called Effective Designs for the Administration of Elections. And it includes things like downloadable graphics files for instructions and various formats of templates for ballots. The problem was there were a number of problems when that report came out. And one of them was that the voting systems that were in place in jurisdictions didn't actually support that design. The other is that there's lots of legislation that embeds design specifications. So in any given state, the typeface, say, may be specified in law. Wow. The typeface, type size, yeah. and other kinds of things like instructions are embedded in laws. And so the local election officials at the county level are a little skittish about taking that on or you know, breaking the law by design, as it were. but the third thing is that it's kind of unusual that there are designers on staff in election departments. Big jurisdictions like Los Angeles County and New York City, Los Angeles County has 4.5 million registered voters. They have people who do design in those offices, but most places, and there are something like 3,800 voting jurisdictions in the United States, don't have designers. The people who lay out the ballots are using really difficult to use systems that are attached to the larger voting systems, and or they send their data to their voting system vendor, and the voting system vendor lays out the ballots. And so anyway, the guidelines that came out of the Design for Democracy project were sort of best case kinds of things and not immediately implementable, although they've taken root in lots of places across the U.S. since 2007, mm-hmm. including Washington, Oregon, Kansas, and a bunch of other wonderful places. But they don't cover sort of, not really edge cases, but problem cases like multi-language ballots. So after the census every 10 years in the United States, election departments in counties are obligated to use the census data to determine how many ballots, how many languages they have to support on their ballots. So in many places now, you have to have at least two languages. And the most common is English and Spanish, or English and Chinese, or English and some other Asian language like Tagalog or Korean or Vietnamese. Some big places like New York and Los Angeles have to support lots and lots of languages on their ballots. Los Angeles now has to support 10 languages. So how do you do that? How do you design a ballot that accommodates all those languages? You can't put them all on the same ballot. What's the optimum that people can use, and where the instructions having the language on the ballot is actually helpful? So there's no good data about that. So that's one area that we want to look at. Vote by mail is really, really big. So while there's a long, long tradition, civic tradition of showing up at the polling place and marking and casting your ballot in this beautiful community ritual, it's not, it really is. People love it. You know, they totally get off on it, but it's not convenient for everybody to do that. And it's also very costly to do that, because you have to find the space to make that happen. You have to get voting systems to those spaces. You have to have people who are temporary workers to check in voters and assist them where they where they need it, and to do all the administration in this distributed way. So that's very, very expensive. So some places have gone to vote by mail, or absentee voting, we also call it, to allow people to vote where they want to vote. And we don't know a lot about the usability issues there. We do know that people make more mistakes when they vote by mail than they do when they are voting in the polling place. So that's big.
So when you say by mail, you mean you don't mean by email. You mean really by the good old snail mail.
Yeah, I do, by regular mail. So a lot of jurisdictions generate. They either use paper ballots in their regular election. Usually these are optically scanned to be counted. So you're either filling in a bubble or a box, or you are connecting an arrow, and the tabulation machine sees those marks and counts them. And so those kinds of ballots get folded up and put into envelopes and sent by sent to people who want to vote by mail instead of voting at the polling place. And then the person sends them back and they get counted centrally. So yeah, there's a lot of paper in this system.
And your project focuses on the usability of those paper ballots or on the entire process?
We are really focusing on design in ballots. There's the processes of getting to having a ballot and what happens after a ballot is marked and cast. Those steps are beyond the scope of this particular project. And there are other people working on those things. And by and large, those steps work pretty well because they're managed by really smart, very experienced election administrators at the local level. And there are pretty standard ways of handling those. But what we see is there's a lot of attention on ensuring that ballots are counted as cast, but I and my colleagues are really the only people who are paying a lot of attention to ensuring that the ballots are cast as intended. And so that's what happened with the butterfly ballot, was that people were not able to vote the way they intended. And so working on design and instructions and the interaction of those things on the ballot face itself can help us make sure that more people are able to vote the way they intend.
Okay. I mean, this is like a wonderful project. But when I sort of try to play devil's advocate, so to say, one could say, okay, there's a group of crazy designers or usability experts who have read Don Quixote, yeah? And now they are trying to save the world. Once you are finished with your research, do you already know what's going to happen next? Do you have people you could really talk to, or how will those documents get used?
I totally believe in world peace through design, by the way.
That's good.
What happens next? So we do this research, and we've learned some lessons over the years about generating large buckets of design specifications, and what we're going to publish first are top 10 guidelines on each of the subject areas that we're looking at. And we're going to print them in small field guides. These look like field notes, basically, you know, little notebooks. Each of the top 10 guidelines will have examples with them. And then we are going to distribute them through a variety of ways. One is that we're hoping that people who back the project will give these things to people who need them. But also, Whitney Quisenberry is keynoting a big conference of election officials at the end of June, and so we're hoping to make a big splash there by giving out copies of the guidelines that we come up with. And in every state in the United States, there are conferences of the county election officials, usually at least twice a year, and one of them usually happens during the summertime. And so we expect to have the research done and the guidelines published by the end of June, the middle of July. And this coincides with those conferences, so we can get the guidelines distributed. But it also coincides with the time when counties start laying out their ballots for the November election.
Right. So people have 30 days to go to support back the project on Kickstarters. And then you will start doing the research and writing down and documenting everything to be done by June.
Yeah, by the end of June. Exactly. Yeah, so the Kickstarter project is called Field Guides to Ensuring Voter Intent. And so if you're looking for it on Kickstarter, you should look for a nonfiction book project. They don't have research projects there. but that's the
I mean, who should ever fund a research project?
Exactly. why would you ever want that? But it does, it did help us make some decisions about what we wanted to do with the data that we were going to generate through this research. And so we are in the midst right now of designing the first couple of field guides that are going to be in the collection based on research that has already been done. I mentioned the plain language instructions project that I did with Ginny Reddish. So we're going to pull the top 10 from that, and that'll be the first of the field guides. We're also going to pull a top 10 that AIGA's Design for Democracy project generated out of the effective designs work that they did, and that will be in one of the field guides. And so look for more on the content and the design of these sweet little books on the Kickstarter page for the project.
Yeah, and I will put a link in the show notes. I mean, this is really not only an interesting, it's a very important project, I think, and this is awesome that you take the time to focus on this problem. Perhaps the last question, you will be speaking or doing a workshop at the IA Summit, I think, right?
Yes, indeed, I will. I'll be doing both a workshop and a talk.
Even better. And will it be a related topic, or will it be something related to this ballot design, or something completely different?
Only in the remotest possible way will these things be related to the ballot design project. I did do a session at IA Summit last year, a design studio where we redesigned ballots. It was really, really fun. And I do these design studios all over the world. It's wonderful to get feedback from Norwegians and New Zealanders about what is insane about the American voting system. But what I'm doing at the IA Summit is a half-day workshop on that I call Making Sense of the Data. And I'll be teaching collaborative methods for analyzing the data once you've done usability testing or user research. So you're working with your team to get to design direction rather than wallowing around in data for a week and then generating a report that nobody's going to read.
Exactly.
I am very against reports. And so I hope that people who come to the workshop who are with me on that, I hope that they will be by the end of the day, because the activities that I'm teaching in that workshop, I think, are really fun and very enlightening to everybody on the teams that I've worked with. So I'm excited about that. And the short talk that I'm going to give is called Deconstructing Delight. There are a lot of people talking about delight and gamification these days, but I think delight doesn't go far enough. And delight is kind of temporary and ephemeral, and we should be looking beyond that. So I've come up with a framework that I'm going to talk about at the IA Summit and explain what some organizations are doing on the web and in mobile to go beyond delight to pleasure, flow, and meaning in the experiences that they're designing.
Sounds great. And actually, this gamification topic and user experience is a very interesting topic, I think. And I was thinking, perhaps coming back for a second to the ballot design, improving the usability of a ballot is one thing, but getting people to vote is a completely different problem, and there might this gamification come into play, perhaps.
Yeah, there's some people who are working on that. Awarding badges for checking in at a polling place on Foursquare, for example. But it turns out that a lot of what drives participation is how closely voters relate to the issues involved in the election and the position of the candidates who are on the ballot. The rest is trying to make it as convenient as possible for voters to vote. So vote by mail is one big way to do that, but also lots of different places in the U.S. are creating things called vote centers that are open for early voting. It's called convenience voting before election day. Or there are lots of other options on that as well. Some places have it, some places don't. So if you're an American voter and you're listening to this, check with your local election office to find out if there's early voting. or vote by mail. And that's, there's some evidence that those things improve participation, but there are also studies around that suggest that it didn't change participation numbers at all. It just moved when people voted to earlier rather than on election day itself. But those things may be a factor of geography. You know, it may be the local culture that is driving that. Nobody really knows for sure.
Complicated thing, definitely. And is this ballot design and the design of democracy, which is crazy complicated, I would think. something you what gets your main focus right now, or do you have like another update of your fantastic book, the Handbook of Usability Testing, or a new book perhaps somewhere in the pipeline?
until November 8th, ballot design will be my main focus, although some of my clients will be distressed to hear that from me. I've also been working for the last couple of years on research on usable security, and have a couple of papers and reports coming out about that. There's some really interesting findings about how people generate and manage passwords, for example, and the burden on users in the course of a day in authenticating online in the course of their normal lives. Just this morning, I was working on a report where we found that on average, our participants authenticated 23 times in a day, and in a work day. That doesn't count anything outside the workday. And that seems like a lot of time when you're looking across a large organization. If you're having, you know, say 3,000 or 10,000 or 30,000 people authenticating 23 times a day.
yeah, definitely.
Right? So we're looking at what the trade-offs there are, and we're hoping that it will stimulate some discussion from security experts about with the business about, are the trade-offs worth it? And are people being authenticated the right way for the right things? So that's one area that I'm working on. I am not, at the moment, working on an update of Handbook of Usability Testing. Seems like people are still using the version that was published in 2008. So
edition,
I'm happy
right?
about that. Yeah, that's the second edition. Yep. But I'm constantly collecting notes for that. And I've had two ideas for books sort of that go beyond a usability testing book. One is
for a change,
because then there'd be pressure to do it. But one is a book about methodology for user research and usability testing for social networks. Because I think we've seen some pretty serious failures over the last couple of years where people's privacy has been violated because the interface and the interaction among people has not been vetted well enough before it went out into the real world, into the wild. So I've been working on that and thinking about that a lot, meeting with smart people who are experimenting, shall we say, with how to get good data and launch good social networks, good social media out into the world that isn't scary or evil. So that's one idea. Also, every time I talk about the deconstructing delight framework, somebody comes up to me and says, you know, there's a book in that, and there might be someday. So I have these widely varied interests, and someday they'll all match up somewhere, probably.
Sounds like a really big book.
Well, I think I have this theory that there's an eventual convergence, right? That usable security stuff, for example, is the last gasp of IT in the UI, you know? It's the thing that we designers still let IT own, and we shouldn't do that because it's wrecking the experience. It wrecks onboarding, it wrecks ongoing use because the security policies are wrong for whatever the use is. People are grossly over-authenticated, and I think this is a huge, huge issue that more and more people, more and more designers are starting to pay attention to, and I think more and more on the business side are starting to pay attention to it because it's costly. It drives business away, or it costs in terms of support money. So there's an experience aspect to that. The design for delight thing for me came from years and years and years of doing usability testing, which is basically a punitive thing, right? You're looking for things that are wrong. And I think as a practice, we are better than that now. You know, we're pretty good at getting to the point where we can eliminate frustration and things, you know, make things not suck. But we don't know a lot about what to do next. And it's not all, you know, giving points or gold stars for filling out your expense report on time. That's not going to motivate people. It's much more subtle than that. And so understanding what goes into that kind of design is I think our next big challenge of the practice. So those two things go together, right? The usable security and the getting beyond not sucking. But also the rethinking how we do user research and usability testing, I think, has to happen because we're using the same tools that I started out using 30 years ago, and they're failing. You know, they're just not telling us what we need to know, and they're not helping us answer questions that we don't know what the question is yet, you know? Mm. So at some level, it all fits together in a little puzzle. For me, at least. I don't know if that's true.
I think there's a bet somewhere in it if there will be one big book or four short ones.
Yes, probably small ones.
Dana, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been super interesting to chat with you, and I would really like to perhaps do another take, and because I would like to ask you so many things about usability, and perhaps we could do something in 2 or 3 months or something whenever you have time to do so.
That'd be great. I would love to do that. Thanks very much for having me on the show, Jan. It's been fun.
Thank you. So greetings to the East Coast, and have a great day.
Thanks much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, you're listening to ITU Radio, the hottest mix in rock and UX.
Life goes in circles and fortune reels round. Limits and clauses consequentially bound by ideas of order and the hems of white nightgowns. But I've been a tiger. I've been a king, I've been under your foot, and I've been under your wing. But that doesn't explain why we do such terrible things. Thinking about God just gets me thinking about whiskey. And talking about love just gets me muddled and misty. I was trying to break free so you wouldn't have to say. I can't be good at everything. I do the best with what I touch the four corners of the sky. But I could fold myself into facets like a diamond, shine with the brilliance of the stars. Well, I can't be half of what you want me to be. Oh, all of who I am. I think you'll take me anyway. You can have me. I'm yours. I'm ready. Amen. Thinking about God just gets me thinking about whiskey. Talking about love just gets me muddled and misty. I was trying to break free so you wouldn't have to say.
Melissa, Misty Weaver, and Stevens. Hey, let's have a look at the upcoming events, okay?
Baby, please don't go. baby, please don't go and leave me here. You know it's cold out here.
Every week there's a conference for us experience design consultants. And if it's not a conference, it's a summit, an Ignite session, a lightning talk, a bar camp, or the plain old speed geeking. Leaving the city is easy, coming home is sometimes hard. This week you could go to so many events, as every week actually. Please take a look at the show notes for the entire list for this upcoming, or actually already a running week. For example, you have the IS Summit, which is coming up. You have the World Storytellers Day, World Storytelling Day actually, and many other events from Sydney to whatever, to San Francisco, all over the world. Please take a look at the show notes.
Baby, please don't go.
Let's close the show with another wonderful sound, sound experience, you could say, by The Doors. And let's listen to Bing Fong Torres announcing The Doors one more time.
The title track of L.A. Woman pays homage to the city that had as much influence over the band and Jim Morrison as anything else they experienced. John Densmore elaborates.
You can't not be affected by the L.A. woman if you live here. A woman as a metaphor for the city. I see your hair is burning, hills are filled with fire. They say I never loved you, you know, they're a liar. I mean, our Santa Ana fires, and it's just really great.
Here's an alternate take of the great title track from Disc 2 of the 40th anniversary edition of L.A. Woman.
About ready to start. Come down an octave or something. So
Oh, Mr. Mojo Rising. 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 Got to keep on rising. Mr. Mojo 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 Rising. Keep on rising. Keep on rising. Rising, rising. Rising. Took a look around me with where the wind blows, with a little girl in a Hollywood bungalow. Oh, you were lucky that lady in the city of light. Oh, just another lost angel, city of night, city of night, city of night.
And that's it for this week's show. Thanks for tuning in. As always, you find all links in the show notes. Please visit bit.ly/ITVRadio for your weekly summary of all things IA, UX, and IXD, and even some usability. Tune in next Monday for your weekly ITV Radio Overdose. Have a great week, and thanks again for listening to episode number 10. Yeehaw! We are binary! Bye-bye.
This episode of IATV Radio is supported by the German IA Summit. The conference takes place May 10th to May 12th, 2012. It's where 400 user experience design professionals from German-speaking Europe meet to learn, network, and chill. To find out more about this upcoming conference, follow the link in the show notes.